Oyez, 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 the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Thank you all. Please be seated, thank you. Good morning, everyone. Justice Kelly, myself, and Justice Ellis are pleased to have you here today. Welcome to the Third Court of Appeals. Before us today, we have cause number 0323531 CV, State of Texas versus the cities of Houston, San Antonio, and El Paso. Councils, can I have your introductions for the court?
Good morning, Your Honor. Vance Kraft, for the appellant, State of Texas. You're ready to proceed.
Thank you.
Can I move into the cities of San Antonio and El Paso, along with Jane Weber? We're also ready. Thank you.
Thank you very much. As you know, we are recording today on YouTube, so hopefully your clients or the like might be observing your performance today. Also, all that will be available to you post presentation, so feel free to check yourself out on our YouTube channel. As we have, it's my understanding the state will take the first 15 minutes, and then I don't know how the cities wish to divide your time, just only one presenter, so 20 minutes, and then we'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal for the state. As you know, once you get to red, please wrap up, and it's time to wind down your thoughts. The yellow light is 2 minutes, and I apologize for my lack of energy today. I feel like I've come down with a cold, so I'm not the most energetic today, but hopefully Justice Ellis and Kelly are feeling better and will pepper you with questions to so that you can share your wisdom with us today. I'll turn the floor over to you, Mr. Kraft. You may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice Byrne, and may it please the court. The court should dismiss this case for lack of jurisdiction for the simple reason that it was brought against the wrong defendant. Our Supreme Court has held that one may not bring a constitutional challenge to a statute against the state of Texas unless there is an enforcement connection between the challenge statute and the state itself. There is no such connection here because the state has no specific role in enforcing the TRCA, and it does not enforce the act against these cities or even threaten to do so.
Who does? What governmental authority does, if anybody?
So,
and I apologize, Justice.
The statute does not assign any enforcement authority to any particular governmental entity or agency. What they have claimed is that essentially everyone has enforcement authority because everyone could be a person within the definition of person under the act who could sue under the act. But if that were enough, that would mean that they could sue everyone in this courtroom or anyone in this courtroom and bring the same lawsuit. Now that seems intuitively wrong. The legal reasons why it's wrong are the doctrines of rightness, standing, and as to the state, sovereign immunity.
But turning back to the chief's question then, who, if anyone, from the state's perspective, has the authority to enforce this?
So, as far as who has the authority, it would be anyone who is a person as defined by the act and who has a claim that they've been injured by a preempted ordinance and could bring a cause of action. But enforcement authority is not enough to establish an enforcement connection for purposes of rightness and standing. Because as this court said in the Trinity Settlement case, there has to be an imminent or sufficiently likely enforcement action in order for a suit to be right. So they would have to bring this suit or a suit, if at all, against somebody who had at least threatened to enforce this against them. And that's not the state of Texas.
But doesn't this act represent a new type of legislation to which traditional standing concepts don't apply? Legislation where enforcement is outsourced to these private third parties by enabling them to bring suit, and then what happens at that point?
Well, traditional standing principles do apply here. Again, I mean, Trinity Settlement was also a pre-enforcement suit, And in that case, there was no question that the person they had sued, the State Securities Board, had authority to enforce that act, and in fact had enforced it against others. But because it had not actually brought any action against the plaintiff, it wasn't right. And there's no exception to traditional standing principles in a case like this. Now, it may be, and this is something that maybe goes to your question, that the Supreme Court recognized in Mouth, which is that standing doctrines sometimes make statutes frustratingly not amenable to constitutional challenge. But nonetheless, they are limits on court subject matter jurisdiction, and it is their burden to prove that they have standing in order to bring it.
So in essence, they have to wait for the 1,000 tiny cuts. You know, Citizen A brings a lawsuit against Houston. Citizen B brings a lawsuit against El Paso because they're upset about this or that. And it's going to take these 1,000 lawsuits against these cities before the issue of constitutionality can be addressed related to this statute?
No, it would not. First of all, as far as waiting goes, the statute does require that anyone who has a claim against them would have to give them notice 3 months in advance before bringing a suit. So that would arguably be a threat against them, and that would be a sufficient threat of an enforcement action to support rightness and standing. But if you're asking, can't they bring some lawsuit to get some sort of global peace as to the constitutionality of the statute on its face, then no, I think there is not such a lawsuit because of the nature of the act.
Okay, so it is going to be death by 1,000 cuts for the cities, right?
I don't think they'll have to wait for 1,000 cuts. So in the example I gave where someone gives them notice, they could preemptively sue on the basis that they have a threatened injury against that person and could raise the constitutionality of the statute in a case like that. Or if someone sues them, they could raise it defensively. And in fact, that's already happened in a case that is in the Dallas Court of Appeals. There's a case involving an organization that has sued the city of Dallas over its short-term rental ordinance, and it's brought several claims, one of which is that ordinance is preempted by this law. And Dallas defended that lawsuit by saying, one, it's not preempted, but two, if it is, this act is unconstitutional. Now, the Dallas Court of Appeals, the panel didn't reach that because it struck down the ordinance on due process grounds. But it is an issue in that case, and there's now a pending en banc petition in that case. But that is how this can be litigated. So it's not just they can never litigate the constitutionality of this act. That is a template in Dallas for how this will be done. And again, eventually, a case like that will reach the Texas Supreme Court, and there will be some binding precedent that speaks to the constitutionality of the act, but a pre-enforcement suit that attempts to get this sort of global peace against the state of Texas is a problem because of rightness, standing, and sovereign immunity, because the state just doesn't have the enforcement connection to this statute that is required. Also, in terms of standing, there's no redressability because this judgment only binds the parties that are in front of you today, but all the injuries they claimed are this act preempts our ordinances. This act exposes us to lawsuits. Indeed, they've conceded that the act is self-enforcing. So even with this judgment, those injuries have not been redressed because anybody else in the state of Texas can sue them under this act. And this judgment is no bar to that. So this judgment can't redress these injuries.
Even if there's a declaration that it's unconstitutional to enforce, how can other lawsuits be brought by other individuals if it is unconstitutional?
Because under the UDJA, a declaratory judgment only binds the parties to that lawsuit. So this judgment only binds the state of Texas, and these three cities. And the Texas Supreme Court addressed this in the Kappmeyer case, which is cited in our brief. It said that because, you know, a declaratory judgment is limited to the parties before it, it doesn't have any binding effect, and anyone can still sue under the statute. And that's the injuries that they're complaining about. They still have those injuries, so they haven't shown redressability, and that's also fatal to their standing. The final jurisdictional problem I wanted to hit is sovereign immunity.
Before you go to sovereign immunity,
sure.
If I could, if you could address ripeness for just a moment.
Sure.
So on page 10 of the appellee's brief, you know, they have a footnote noting that there's already been a lawsuit filed, it looks like, in San Antonio in the 57th District Court, and asks us to take judicial notice of the pleadings in that action. In your view, can we do that? And also, does that solve the ripeness issue? And if not, why?
So first, you can take judicial notice of that suit. Second, it doesn't solve the ripeness problem in this case. And that's this court's decision in the Atmos Energy case, which is very similar to the situation you're describing. In that case, it involved a price control statute for natural gas. And some private parties sued natural gas sellers out in West Texas under this statute. While that was pending, the natural gas sellers brought a UDJA action against the Attorney General. And this court held that that suit was not ripe because the Attorney General had not threatened to enforce that statute against those plaintiffs. And the fact that somebody else in another lawsuit had sued them under that statute was irrelevant. And it was a very similar lawsuit. They said, we want declarations that the statute doesn't apply to us, and if it does, it's unconstitutional. And in Atmos Energy, this court said, you can't bootstrap some other lawsuit to create ripeness vis-a-vis the Attorney General or the state. That's the ripeness problem.
And how do you square Texas Association of Business versus Austin, a paid sick leave case on the ripeness issue?
So again, in that case, just because the state of Texas had intervened in that lawsuit and asserted an interest against the city of Austin in that case, doesn't mean that it's likely to enforce this act against these plaintiffs. That's the city of Austin versus Paxton case out of the Fifth Circuit. You can't go back and say, well, the state intervened in these other cases, so that makes it at least sufficiently likely that they'll do it here.
Well, I'm not talking about necessarily the state intervening, but just the likelihood of injury, because part of your position is that it's a pre-enforcement action, and in that case we talk about, you know, the likelihood of the ordinance being enforced once effective, along with the probability that the private parties would comply, is a sufficient threat of actual injury.
I there still has to be a threat of injury by the defendant.
Okay.
It can't just be an abstract threat by someone else. Before I sit down, I do want to address.
Sure. One more thing. Does the state qualify as a person under the act?
I'm not going to concede that today, Justice Ellis. You know, they have said that it does because one person includes agency or instrumentality. That's wrong. There are agencies and instrumentalities of the state of Texas, but the state is not itself an agency or instrumentality.
And would you consider a legal entity?
So that is the other part of it. I think if you pull that in isolation, I mean, the state of Texas is a legal entity. Contextually, it's kind of an odd fit because it sort of presumes that the cities would be regulating the state of Texas. But I don't think you have to decide that in this suit, because even if you assume for the sake of argument the state is a legal entity and therefore a person who could sue under the act, it's not enough for ripeness and standing or for the UDJA that they could sue. They have to have at least threatened to sue, and they haven't done that. The state hasn't done that to these cities. So turning to the merits, Most of the arguments here are about the Home Rule Amendment, and they've really made three main arguments. All of them are foreclosed by the City of Laredo case. First, they argue that there has to be a direct conflict between state law and federal law. We can't preempt a field. That's wrong under City of Laredo, because there, the preemption occurred not because the state was regulating plastic bags differently from Laredo. It was because state law said that local governments may not adopt ordinances on certain subjects except as authorized by the state or by state law. That's really all the TRCA does, just on a larger scale. So that kind of preemptive, you can't regulate in this area, is perfectly legitimate under the Home Rule Amendment.
But it's expanding the legislature or the state has expanded the powers that are taken away from the cities with the way the Constitution was set up, that the cities essentially were self-governing, except it was limited by the legislature, and now they've expanded it to include these eight different sections that can essentially minimize the city's powers.
Yeah, and that is really the second argument they've made, that somehow this is nullifying Home Rule. That's also permitted under City of Laredo. City of Laredo said that self-governing authority can be legislatively abrogated, and they can be made functionally analogous to general law cities. And that is what the TRC does as to those subjects you mentioned. The final argument they make under the Home Rule Amendment is that it doesn't preempt with unmistakable clarity. And there they're conflating two issues. What City of Laredo says is that what has to be unmistakably clear is the legislature's intent to preempt. Whether the scope of preemption encompasses a particular ordinance is just a matter of ordinary statutory construction. And you see that in City of Laredo. There, the unmistakable clarity discussion was very short. It just said, the statement in the act says, local government or other political subdivision may not adopt certain ordinances. That's all you need for unmistakable clarity, and we have that in the TRCA.
Thank you, Council. All right, let's hear from the cities.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to spend most of my time today on the substance of the vagueness question and the Home Rule Amendment today, but I will answer questions about the jurisdictional issues that he's addressed, if there are any additional ones. But let me just say a couple of things about that initially. Texas is a proper party here because it has threatened to sue or threatened to intervene in constitutional challenges in this case. It's at the record at page 305. It's mentioned in our brief at page 65. And that requires standing to sue. So this idea that it can intervene at will, but we cannot sue, the city cannot sue, I think is a little bit disingenuous. But there are other reasons why Texas is a proper party. Where the law's validity is challenged, Houston has a justiciable connection. That's that Texas Board of Chiropractors case where the alleged injury was traceable to the board's rulemaking and would have redressed here by the judicial invalidation of the challenge rule. That's exactly the case here because Houston has not received any notice letters since this provision was declared unconstitutional. That has redressed the injuries here. In addition, Houston has pleaded a direct enforcement connection. Now, Texas has tried to improperly heighten that by saying that it needs to be some kind of imminent threat. Although we have that here, it's not necessary, and that's in the Malk case that we cite at page 62 of our brief. But the state has a variety of enforcement mechanisms, not just only that they are have state agencies and essentially he conceded were a legal entity under the enforcement mechanisms of 2127, but unlike the abortion statutes that make this the exclusive remedy, it is not the exclusive remedy here. And there's also, unlike the abortion statutes, no exclusion of the state from enforcement. State could bring an ordinary common law action.
Ms. Petty, I have a question about,
sure,
going to the redressability. So you contend the city's claims are traceable to and redressable by the state because the state has enforcement authority under the act. You say the state has enforcement authority because the state qualifies as a person and may therefore bring a cause of action. Since the act broadly defines the term person, we discussed that earlier, wouldn't almost anyone qualify as having enforcement authority under the act and therefore subject to declaratory judgment action? And even though the act broadly defines person, doesn't the act's history and context indicate that legislature intended the act to be enforced primarily by members of the business community?
That may well have been their intent, but as I've indicated, there are a variety of means by which they can enforce other than the statute itself. The state is trying to suggest that the statutory provision is the only one that provides them with the remedy, but they have conceded that they can simply intervene based on the independent standing that they have in any challenge in any other case where the constitutionality of 2127 is at issue. And the Texas Board of Chiropractors case says not that there's an enforcement connection, but there's a connection because they're the author of the bill. The state is the author of the bill. And at note 149, that's what they talk about. So there's a variety of connections there that Houston has been able to plead and to go through. Just one section on ripeness. The Perry versus Del Rio case says that claims of lack of ripeness when there was, if this was a pre-filing case, don't require dismissal. And so I'm not really sure why he is focused on that today. Houston has listed a number of harms that it was suffering prior to filing. It wasn't anticipatory. The chaos in trying to implement it, the problems with the maintain language in there that requires Houston essentially to prepare to repeal offending local ordinances. In addition, I would call the court's attention to the elected officials brief and the Humane Society that talks about the specific impact.
So what are the city's concrete injuries that give them standing and make their claims right?
Well, I've listed quite a few, but we specifically talked about, I just talked about the difficulty in trying to survey the legislation that we have or the ordinances that we have to find out which ones we can no longer maintain. That's a provision under the act that says that we can't keep those in effect. So we have to review all of those. Second, we specifically identified the pay or play program that we have that is funded by insurance payments for the city's contractors that funds other programs. And so not only will Houston have to find another home for those programs, but it will have to find another way of doing that, and it will have to repeal that program. There's also the deterrent effect of the regulation, and the elected officials brief lists for very specific cities all over the state various problems that they would have. There's also the deterrent effect of on regulation. The idea, and frankly it's admitted by the authors, that this was intended to be a living document. It was intended to be vague on purpose, I think is the term that they used, in order to chill additional regulation. And that, under those circumstances, under the Rourke and Hardy case that we cite at page 68 and 69 of our brief, the hardship element for ripeness is satisfied. The only other consideration for the court is the fitness of the issue for decision. This is a pure legal issue and statutory interpretation, so it's clearly ready to go.
Ms. Petty, you mentioned there were no other letters of intent to file that have been filed against the
Houston has not received notice letters as of last week.
So none. Okay.
And we believe that is directly traceable to the fact that we filed this lawsuit, we had the provision declared unconstitutional, and we let everybody know that we had it declared unconstitututional.
So currently, is there only one letter, only one lawsuit affecting San Antonio that's been filed, or letter of intent that's floating out there against the cities?
That's the only one I'm aware of, but if there have been those sent in other cities, if somebody doesn't call us about those, there's not really a central repository about that. But I think this goes to the redressability question, is that by bringing suit against the state of Texas and not some random person who might be qualified as a person under there. By suing the state of Texas and having the provision declared unconstitutional in a case against the state of Texas, that has sent, I think, a signal to the business community that this statute is probably on its way out. And so why don't you wait at least until something changes before you file suit?
What of Mr. Kraft's argument that this, that there will be a vehicle and one's already in the hopper, so to speak, in Dallas for challenging this suit, but, you know, that would be the more appropriate vehicle for this type of constitutional challenge than a pre-enforcement challenge that's being litigated here?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, we're really no longer a pre-enforcement challenge. We're kind of under kind of the Perry versus Del Rio. This went into effect 2 days after the court declared it unconstitutional. We did not get an injunction. We did not seek an injunction. And so we're dealing now with a slightly different situation. But even though we filed it pre-enforcement, we identified existing harms at the time, and it's well settled in Texas jurisprudence that cities do not have to wait until the sky falls, particularly in situations like this where they are charged with enforcement. One of the things you didn't hear Mr. Kraft talk about was the Nuzzi line of cases, Nuzzi, Neely, Wilson, Proctor line of cases that say that cities who are charged with implementing statutes, as Houston has, or Houston is, must have the opportunity to challenge the constitutionality of those statutes, and often before they go into effect, so that Houston can avoid, for example, paying all the fees. Not only are we going to be sued, but the city will have to pay the fees in those cases. And so cities under that line of cases, which the only thing I think they've argued on those is that somehow they're no longer in effect. But that's not an effective argument because they clearly are. City has a right to get a pre-enforcement challenge and not to have all the harms of the statute fall upon it before it gets decided, and particularly decided in a case against the state of Texas, so that it will have wide play. With that, I'd like to, if I may, turn to vagueness.
I'm sorry. I'm gonna make sure I have two more questions to make sure I get in. So you contended that the justiciable controversy exists because cities may not enforce or maintain any local enactment that is preempted under the Act's terms. Can you provide a few examples of local enactments the city would like to but can't enforce because they are preempted?
Well, the example that we give in our brief is our pay-or-play ordinance. And that is one in which the city requires that city contractors either provide workers' compensation insurance or pay into a fund that would pay that. That money is not only used for insurance, but it's also used for other purposes. Under 2127, which affects the labor code, we believe, although it's hard to tell because the statute is so vague, we believe that that statute would be one of the ones that would be affected. And so we would not only have to find another way to make sure that city contractors were insured, but also find a new home and new funding for the programs that the pay or play provision, funds. So that's just one example. But again, I think
Do you have any other examples?
The Humane Society, for example, filed an entire brief on the question of regulating animals. And it's an excellent brief, and I commend that to you. That's one of the things that they would not be able to do. And the problem with the maintain is not only would those be considered preempted, but cities have an affirmative obligation, we believe, under 2127, to take that stuff off the books, just to salt the earth. And that's the problem that is primarily focused on the pre-enforcement problem is cities are having to, before it ever went into effect, having to go through all of their ordinances, charter provisions, which require votes, public votes, to figure out how they're going to get these things off the books, purge everything that's preempted before it goes into effect and they're subjected to a lawsuit.
And I know you want to get to vagueness. I have one more question.
That's fine.
It's okay.
This is yours.
If the court is inclined to sustain the state's first issue on ripeness or standing, should the cities be afforded the opportunity to replead?
Yes, because the ripeness issues and the standing issues that they raised were all raised newly on appeal. They've had a number of lawyers change, but they've changed their arguments both times, and so the city should have an opportunity to do that. However, I think that between the Patel case, the Perry versus Del Rio case that we cite at page 67, the El Cenizo case, Texas versus United States case, where there was no ripeness challenge, where cities were required to implement challenge law, we cite that at page 71 of our brief, note 185, that the court really shouldn't consider sustaining that point on ripeness, because the case is ripe, and if it was not ripe when filed, it is ripe now, and under Perry Del Rio, that is not a basis for dismissal.
And but counsel, may I ask, you've used the word implement numerous times, and on page 6 of the state's reply, they state the following, but as the state explained, the cities do not implement the TRCA in the relevant sense because they are not charged with taking affirmative action to give it effect. How would you respond to that? Because you've used the word implement numerous times.
It's dead wrong. I've spoken a bit during this argument about the maintain provision. Texas cities have to take affirmative action to review their ordinances and charters to determine if they are maintaining any preempted provisions. And so that's number one. Number two, with our pay or play, as a practical matter, cities are having to look at the regulations that they may view as preempted and have to find new homes for their programs. For example, there's a healthcare program that the pay or play provision enforces. We have to find a new funding source for that. So I find it ironic that the state is so precise on its interpretation of implement and so narrow in its interpretation of implement, and yet it wants the court to say that there's nothing vague about the rest of 2127.
And what if Houston scours its charter and ordinances and misses one? I mean, what is your concern in that regard?
Our concern is that we will then be sued. And if we miss, and we will miss some because of vagueness of the statute. You know, it's hard to know what a field occupied by a provision of a listed code is. And so the problem here is the chilling effect that that will have on Houston from either maintaining regulations that are close to the line or in enacting new regulations that might also be close to the line. And that's the problem with not satisfying the unmistakable clarity standard that is required of preemption statutes and that 2127 so badly violates. And with that, I'd like actually to talk about that. The unmistakable clarity provision or the unmistakable clarity standard is one that applies to preemption statutes. Again, Mr. Kraft is trying to sort of parse, saying that it applies to the enthusiasm of the legislature in preempting it, but they can basically say, pass a statute that would say the state really, really wants to outlaw or preempt local statutes that they don't like and leave that to the courts. That would pass constitutional muster under the interpretation that he's offered. Again, these are arguments that were raised for the first time on appeal. The statute doesn't define what a field is. It offers no definition of the scope, no way for cities to know what is actually preempted and what isn't. And the best way to tell that is to go back to Houston's motion, where we took statutory provisions out of the various codes and said, okay, this chiropractor provision that talks about delegation of chiropracting duties, what's the field? How do you define the field? And what other provisions does it get rid of? The whole purpose of the unmistakable clarity standard is to let everybody know very clearly what's in and what's out. And that's the problem with 2127, if it does not do that. There are other provisions that we've talked about, the expressly authorized, for example, provision. One of the problems that 2127 has is it kind of stacks ambiguity on ambiguity. If you don't know what's in the field, if you don't know what's preempted, you also don't know what needs to be expressly authorized. And in the case of home rule cities, very little is expressly authorized because they have had the authority to regulate on their own. And so there are numerous provisions in the statutes that say, that recognize home rule authority. It's unclear if those would be enough express authorization to allow Houston to enforce those provisions. In addition, it shifts the burden of proof. We've talked about shifting from inconsistency to consistency. We've talked about maintain, and we've talked about the uneven notice that they provide. With that, let me just talk about the Home Rule Amendment, because he did talk about that. To reverse the trial court in this case, this court has to violate two provisions of the Constitution and defy five well-established provisions or principles that have been long reaffirmed by the Texas Supreme Court. We know the Home Rule Amendment, you would have to overturn, because the state admits, that they eliminate its conflict requirement. They make no bones about that. They eliminate the conflict requirement. And contrary to what Mr. Kraft told you, Laredo, and there's no Texas case that eliminates the conflict requirement. Instead, Laredo proudly reaffirms the conflict requirement and says, in the language that quotes from Glass or Tyra, that basically it is through conflict that the state can remove areas of regulation from the from local governments, that it's not without the conflict requirement. Instead, they have basically reaffirmed that 2127 has, they reaffirm that their local laws are preempted only to the extent of any conflict, and that's what 2127 eliminates. Also, because 2127 rewrites Article 9, Section 5, to eliminate the conflict requirement, it is a failed constitutional amendment. So you have to go against those.
Ma'am. And Council, you'll need to wrap up.
Okay. Your Honor, let me just list those. It reaffirms the conflict requirement. It would violate the requirement that the principle that mere entry of the field of regulation does not preempt. That's basically what 2127 does. You would have to violate the notion that parallel regulation is not preempted, because 2127 preempts it, that the burden on preemption is on the proponent to show inconsistency, not the city for consistency. And finally, you'd have to eviscerate the unmistakable clarity standard. So for all those reasons, I'd ask the court to affirm the decision of the district court.
Thank you. Let's hear from the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kraft, will you respond to the city's argument that the state has already threatened to intervene, and I believe they gave a cite to 305 in the record?
Yes. So what they're referring to is a statement that was made that the Attorney General would intervene to defend the constitutionality of this statute. That's not a threat by the state of Texas to enforce this statute. For one thing, the Attorney General and the state are not interchangeable. As the Supreme Court explained in the Volkswagen case, we don't have a unitary executive. So you can't just mix and match members and agencies of the executive branch. So the Attorney General's vow to intervene doesn't say anything about the state of Texas and what it might do. But moreover, defending the constitutionality of a statute is not enforcing it against a city. It's just saying the statute is valid. So the state has not threatened to enforce this statute in any way. And all of the harms that Ms. Petty mentioned when she was up here are all traceable to the statute itself, not to the state of Texas. And what I heard were really three reasons why they think they can nonetheless proceed against the state of Texas. One is the intervention argument that Justice Kelly just asked me about. Again, that is invalid. Second, the chiropractic board case, that is really just an attempt to dodge what Malk says. In the chiropractic case, the court said there was sufficient enforcement authority because this agency had been tasked with adopting rules to enforce a statute, and that was enough of an enforcement action. But they're relying on that for you can sue the author. Malk says very clearly you cannot sue the state of Texas merely because the legislature enacted the statute. They do rely on Malk for the enforcement argument as well. Malk is a little bit different because there the state had no enforcement authority, so the court could stop there. But enforcement authority, while it may be necessary, it's not sufficient. You still have to have threatened to use that authority against the plaintiff, and the state of Texas hasn't done that here.
Can I hop in for one moment? Would you address Justice Ellis's question to your friends on the other side? If we find that there is a ripeness issue or standing issue, should the plaintiffs be given an opportunity to replead?
No, because they haven't shown how they would cure that problem. And it's not curable vis-a-vis the state of Texas. And we know from the Supreme Court's decision in Mattson versus McLean that the allowance for repleading is not a license to go file a new lawsuit. It's to cure allegations that are insufficient. And here, I mean, we're dealing with legal issues, and there's simply no legal basis to sue the state. There wasn't when they filed this, there isn't now. And all of these, and to the extent they're relying on what I heard Ms. Petty to say is, we've raised these jurisdictional arguments for the first time on appeal, that's not correct. We raised rightness and standing and sovereign immunity in our motion to dismiss. Those are all in the record.
How does one get rid of an unconstitutional statute if you have to do it by the onesies, responding with an affirmative defense to Ms. Smith in El Paso and to, X Corporation in Houston? How do you stop the bleeding? Is there any way, if a court in Houston determines it's unconstitutional and a court in Dallas determines it's unconstitutional, does it just have to trickle up to the Supremes? Is that your answer? I mean, you can't do a one and done. State of Texas, you wrote it, or the legislature did, and we should be able to get rid of it in one fell swoop.
You certainly cannot rely on the fact that the legislature wrote it. That's what Malk says. Again, I understand the question that they would like to get some sort of global peace as to the constitutionality of the statute. That can't happen in a statute like this. Now, most statutes that we have, it can happen because there's really only one state agency that's enforcing it, so you sue the only agency that could actually enforce it against you, and you get some ruling on the constitutionality. For this, it is going to have to be litigated and go up to the Supreme Court before we get some kind of final binding disposition on the constitutionality of the statute.
Because the state delegated their authority to enforce to every Tom, Dick, and Harry in the state.
The state didn't delegate that authority. It just created a cause of action for anyone who's been injured. This was never the state statute to enforce, particularly because it's about trade and commerce. That is the real reason why it's been given to individuals to bring a cause of action under this statute.
But you're not conceding, or you're not saying that any of this, whether it be the Attorney General or any of the state agencies, couldn't enforce this right? You're not willing to make that statement.
I'm not going to make that disclaimer, but as we pointed out in our brief, the lack of a disclaimer is not proof of a ripe injury or standing. Any such suit that you've described is purely speculative at this point, and that's just not enough to sustain jurisdiction in this case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court will stand in recess, and this case is submitted. Thank you very much.